Okay, that's it. It's happening now. Were you expecting like, go?
I thought, or? Yeah, no, action? No. No, I'm very excited.
Nick is a delight. Among other things, he has a passion for film. So get ready for a lot of references, which he used during our chat to illustrate his story. When I first approached him for this podcast, the options felt endless, but all within one singular theme.
We're talking about showing up in places that you don't feel are made for you, or like imposter syndrome with a dash of being part of an underrepresented group, with a dash of self-doubt, with like some cherries and some vermouth in there.
Existing in a world not made for you. When I asked Nick why this was important, the answer was simple. The story needed to be told.
To be honest, I don't think it's talked about a ton. And I think the narrative and the flip that I see come out usually like puts it on the person who's talking about it, right? There was this amazing clip recently of America Ferrera where she was kind of talking about imposter syndrome, and she felt that imposter syndrome isn't an accurate name. I'm feeling the way that it was designed to make me feel. Being in this room and not feeling like this room was made for me, or I don't fit into this room, that is not coincidental or accidental or any of those things. It really isn't on the individual. It's really on the people in that room to make that person feel more welcome. So that is, I think, a useful topic. I have experience in it, you know, kind of always being on the outside looking in.
Before we continue, it's important to acknowledge.
I'm always speaking from like my perspective as a gay man living in the United States. I can't speak on other people's identities or stories, and I don't want to generalize the experience for other gay men. There's all sorts of different experiences out there.
With that out of the way, let's dig in. First, what's it like?
I constantly have this feeling like, is it me? This isn't the norm, or that's not how this goes, or that's not people's experience, or you should care about these things. Just these cues and signals that you get, oh, this wasn't created for you.
Even when being othered, a routine feeling at this point in his life, Nick has this incredible gift of empathy. I asked if he had a recent experience he'd feel comfortable sharing. It was easy to pick.
We're planning a wedding right now, and that has just been a really big one. You know, I'm a man marrying a man in Massachusetts, right? Like the state that legalized gay marriage, and you're still bumping into these indicators of like heteronormative kind of Christian American marriage. And that's not going to be my experience getting married. And the people who I have bumped into those experiences with, I give grace to, because 90% of the people or 85% or whatever of the people that they are dealing with are members of that group, right? And I had to fill out a form for a photographer who I loved, and it was like groom and bride. I had like, you know, sought out photographers that had queer couples represented kind of in their portfolio, and it's like, oh, you were so close.
For many, changing bride and groom to partner one and partner two on a web form is not even an afterthought. It doesn't make the list of things to consider. Such an easy fix would make a difference.
We got our taxes done recently. They were like, is there a Mrs.? And I was like, there's a Mr., which immediately puts people on the defensive. They feel awful, edge. And they immediately have to start, you know, telling you about every queer person they've ever met, and, you know, how they watched Will and Grace in the 90s, and, which is sweet, but, you know, it's okay. I don't think that this was a, you know, like a hate crime. It's okay. And so you're constantly having to put people at ease all the time too. So there's like this exhaustion of it happening to you. And then there's this exhaustion of like, you kind of constantly have to be like, oh, no worries. I know you didn't mean that.
The exhaustion of the experience, coupled with the energy it takes to constantly make others feel okay, is profoundly tiresome and a reminder that, once again, this space did not have you in mind. Taking a step back from marriage and taxes for the moment, let's get to know Nick. Let's learn about him and his upbringing right outside of Boston.
My parents are Irish and Italian, Catholic family. I have like two older siblings. And idyllic in some ways, to be 100% honest with you. Massachusetts is a beautiful place, and grew up going to the Cape in the summer, which is just beautiful and gorgeous. And so there's really stunning parts of it. And my mom is one of 12 siblings, which is kind of crazy for people to hear. So I have like 40 something first cousins on that side. And my family is just really massive. And it's just like an Irish Catholic gaggle of people. And it's loud and chaotic and fun and crazy. And there's just so many people.
Nick had a grandmother that he adored, the one that raised all 12 of those kids. And she told it like it was. She wasn't demonstrative with her affection. His parents, too. Though full of love, pride, and joy, they often kept a safe distance from conveying it. That seems to be a theme where he's from.
I think there's this Boston attitude of, who do you think you are? My parents definitely, they're like, kiss the child when the child's asleep. It's like a stiff upper lip, the remnants of Irish, kind of English roots still very much exist in the Northeast. You know, get up, walk it off, you know, knock it off, you're fine, were phrases I heard my entire youth.
But there were lessons learned from that.
You could have just gotten pulled to the ground and they just tell you to like stand up and keep on walking, which is useful in life. You're fine. Come on. Maybe isn't the best way to learn resilience, but it does teach you how to be resilient.
Nick is one of the younger of those 40 cousins. Only a couple are younger than him. So he had a wealth of examples of how to be, how things are, and what was quote unquote normal. Early on in his timeline, he felt outside of that reality.
I knew that I was different, in air quotes, from a very young age. I remember being a young boy and I wanted to meet Anne of Green Gables in the sandbox, and the other boys would be like wrestling and talking about Ninja Mutant Turtles, and I was like trying to build clothes for dolls. I used to like cut apart plastic cups to use for boning to make clothes. I had American Girl dolls and I like, didn't want anyone to touch them. I wanted their clothes to be perfect. And I was like 5, 6 going to the library, pulling out books on like costume sign and recreating those costumes for Barbies with whatever materials we had available.
Nick stood out and remembered that when he was young, that wasn't always a good thing. Thankfully, his mom was his biggest fan.
My mom is incredibly progressive. In the early 90s, had a boy who wanted his nails painted and wanted a Barbie doll and, you know, was very fascinated by Eartha Kitt, and she just thought it was great. She didn't think that I needed to be any other way. So I became obsessed with like symphonic old recordings, which is very strange for a child. But I remember going to school and I was getting bullied because I was like talking to people about My Fair Lady and trying to talk to them about how the symphonic recording is so different and the symphony is so big. Hear the motifs and the themes, and my mother being like, no 8-year-old boy wants to talk about that with you, you know, and she was saying it from a loving place.
And he found allies in other places too.
I was getting made fun of constantly because I was going and talking about Balanchine and Surratt and John Singer Sargent and Bernadette Peters and Judy Garland and Lena Horne, and the lady across the street was an incredible resource for me. Her name was Lee, and I used to go there after school. She was like 100% a recluse. When she was in her 20s, the late teens, her parents sent her to Paris, and she started the Sorbonne, which is a famous school in Paris. It studied fashion design, and her job in the 60s was to go to Paris and to go to all of these couture houses and kind of examine what was coming down the runway. She would put like these lookbooks together of what Givenchy or, you know, Yves Saint Laurent or kind of what all these French designers were coming out, and she would bring those books back to the United States and she would show them to very rich women in cities to kind of show them what was coming down the runway in the spring of 1962 or something. So I used to hang out with her after school and she taught me about French kind of haute couture, and I took piano lessons there. And it was funny, I was thinking about this. She used to give me ginger ale and champagne flutes. I asked them to be shed like beautiful, like, you know, Simon Pierce or some kind of fancy cut crystal champagne flute. And I used to ask the ginger ale to be served in those. And then this is such a niche thing, but there used to be these oranges, these chocolate oranges that you would get at the grocery store. And the way to open them was you'd have to bang them on the counter.
Yeah, I remember these. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I would, you know, drink ginger ale out of these champagne in quotes, out of these kind of crystal cut flutes. And we would eat these chocolate oranges and she would play Chopin or kind of whatever I wanted to hear. And so that's what I did like most days after school.
Nick spent his time with Lee sipping champagne, out of cut crystal, playing piano, and learning to draw. She taught him about French Impressionists, and his mother would then take him to the Museum of Fine Arts.
I was lucky. I had people around me who were interested in the things that were interested in me, and my mother was supportive and interested too.
Home was a safe space, and he could always go to Lee's. But there were many times that Nick felt like he was on the outside. He sometimes felt small.
I mean, people didn't know what to do with me. In school, they were just confounded. I was trying to talk to kids about Anne Margaret and movies from the 40s, and Busby Berkeley, who was like a famous choreographer in the 40s. And I was like, oh, he would look through a kaleidoscope, and that's how, and people were like, shut up. You know, like, why are you talking to me about Busby Berkeley movies? Like, no one even knows what that is.
And still, with his mother's help, he persisted.
I started ballet. And I remember the movie Billy Elliot. It came out in the 90s, maybe the 2000s. And it was about a boy growing up in England whose father's a miner, and he ends up going to ballet class. And there's a hilarious quote where the father finds out he's doing ballet, and he's like, boys do wrestling and football, not freaking ballet. My mother took me to see that movie because at the end of the movie, spoiler, sorry, it's a 20-year-old movie, but you haven't seen the ending.
it's kind of on
you,
but
yeah, you're a little late. So at the end of the movie, Billy Elliot ends up in like the National Ballet Company of England, and his father goes, and he has a gay friend who is at the show with him, and his father's incredibly proud, and the movie kind of ends with Billy Elliot kind of jumping across the stage. And I think my mother wanted to show me at 7 or 6 or however old I was, that there was a big world out there, and I might feel small in this little town and people not know what, you know, I wasn't allowed to go play at certain kids' homes, right? Like, there was definitely a lot going on, but I think my mother wanted to show me that there's a big world out there, right? And like, you might not fit in here in this small town where people just aren't exposed to the things that you're talking about, or you're different and you're sticking out. And when people stick out, kind of other people don't know what to do with that, right? She wanted to show me that there were other options out there.
Nick believes that people are inherently good. When others don't know what to do with him, like his knowledge of Impressionist art or 1960s high fashion, that's on them. But ultimately, he does think that they're coming from a place of goodness. He was raised that way. But I asked him how he keeps this mindset going.
I know what it's like to be on the outside or trying to get in all the time. And I don't want anybody to feel that way. And I think you can kind of take what life did to you or life has done to you, and you can become bitter and resentful, or you can make sure that it doesn't happen to other people. It's funny, all these years later, talking to all these people that I grew up with, and it's like, you know, the blonde, pretty girl who's dating the football player also feels like an outsider in her group and is being bullied, you know. And so people's lives are truly never what they appear to be. And I think I've always been fascinated by the human condition, and I think that's where I give grace from, right? I'm a human being, they're a human being. If I believe in this inherent goodness, then I have to try to see the good in them. I remember my mother saying to me as a young child, like, there's nothing that you could do that would make me not love you. I believe you were made in God's image exactly the way that you are. So if you were made in God's image, then you shouldn't be different. That is really powerful, and kind of extending that grace onto others, right? And don't get me wrong, there are days where I'm resentful.
Sure.
Right?
And it's a battle. It's a daily battle.
Yeah. Like, you know.
Is your mom taking applications for additional children? Because, my goodness.
No, she's full, I think. She's amazing. I'm incredibly lucky, and I love her so much.
With this perspective that others deserve kindness and empathy, there were still moments in school where his conviction to be who he was, all else be damned, was very exposing.
In third grade, I chose to do my report on Bernadette Peters. She's beautiful, red curly hair, and she looks like a Botticelli painting, and she just is incredible, and she emotes, and I just thought she was amazing. Not common. A lot of other boys were doing, you know, David Ortiz or Drew Bledsoe, you know, or other kind of athletes. And I came in ready to kind of do Bernadette Peters. And I remember that my aunt lived close. My aunt didn't have kids, and she's incredible, another incredible woman in my life. She lived nearby. She was over all the time. I remember her saying, the teacher must have told my mom or something that, you know, oh, he did his report and, you know, people had some comments. And so I did my report on Bernadette Peters and sure got made fun of. And I went home and somebody must have given my mom a heads up. And my aunt was there and she was like, oh, hey, bud, you know, I heard that today was hard and people might have teased you a bit because you, and I was like, yeah, like, whatever. Like, they don't even know who Bernadette Peters is. I was so convinced that I was not the problem in that scenario. You know, I really didn't see a problem with it, which was great in some ways. And it also was harder because it definitely put a huge red target on my back.
In high school, there was more of the same.
My car got vandalized in high school. They poured fish juice down the vents of my car. So anytime you turned the heat on, it was awful.
Nick came out at 15, one of 400. He was the only openly gay student in his high school.
It was not a receptive place to people kind of living their true lives and kind of coming out. And I felt like my hand was forced.
His classmates effectively stole his story, saying everyone already knew, and they talked about it often.
I came out and it was awful, and it was really, 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 really hard.
This was Nick's story to tell when he was ready. Sadly, he didn't quite get that experience. After coming out, others around him worked hard to make sense of it in the way that they knew how. This is a common experience and not a good one.
I've talked to other kind of queer people, but sometimes people will say this, and again, like, I don't think their intentions are bad, but they'll say like, your parents must have known, or your teachers or your cousin or your pastor or whoever, they must have known. And it's like, it's not about them knowing, right? Like, first of all, it's incredibly insulting. It assumes that like everybody is in on the joke or the gig or the gag or whatever that I am not in on, right? It's not about them knowing. It's about me knowing and me feeling comfortable and me wanting to tell people that and share that part with my world. Appreciate straight allies and people who try to understand, but it's a part of life and experiences that you can't understand unless it's something that you've gone through.
So he continued on. Jumping into his high school theater program, he was exposed to the classics.
The Salesman and Streetcar Named Desire, read Medea, read Long Day's Journey into the Night.
And he learned to go deeper into people's behavior.
I'm definitely someone who wants to get to the inside of the onion, like peel back all those layers. When I watch a movie, it's not enough to watch the movie. I need to listen to the director's commentary, and I need to watch behind the scenes, and I need to listen to the costume designer's arc, and I want like the whole, what did it take to get this movie made? I'm just not satisfied watching a good movie. I watched Poor Things on Sunday. Great. Everybody should watch it. Bizarre, fever dream. And I immediately started Googling, like, who's this costume designer and why'd she make those choices and why is she not wearing shoes? Because I want to hear the justification, because I find the justification so interesting, because there is justification if somebody's doing their job well, right?
Right, yeah.
And so.
And it's so interesting, if I may just quickly, this connection between how I watched Poor Things a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I Googled who the cast was. You Google. Yeah. Why did they make these decisions and who are these decision makers and what's their background? And I think it just is so telling about how you walk through the world and are able to navigate all of these people and their different backgrounds and consider them, where I, unfortunately, often don't consider those things or those individuals.
Nick's innate ability to think about the whole picture when interacting within the parameters of our society is impressive. A student of human behavior, he has a deep curiosity for not only an individual's origin story, but also their motivations and hopes. This serves him well. In the space where resentment or bitterness could quickly grow, other, more productive things have.
I have a loving partner and we own an old Victorian home. We love old homes. And so we own a whole home together and it's littered with, you know, coffee table books about, I don't know, British Vogue and signs from small seaside towns that we've like loved and gone to together and kind of pillaged for antiques and stuff like that. So I've definitely found my place in the world.
But even with this beautiful life that genuinely feels like a movie, there is doubt.
I'm not my number one supporter in my fan club, far from it. And I'm in my mid-30s and it's, you know, I always joke that like I'm really going to hit my stride in my 80s.
But the doubt gets quieter as each year passes, beginning to dull, more peaceful than it once was. And yet, There are moments when he is reminded, sometimes like a slap, and others a little pinch, of how much on the outside he is.
I had a funny one. We love to host. I want people in my home. I love it. It was fall time when I had a family party. You know, it was like a traditional Sunday dinner, and for Italian Sunday dinner, and for people who kind of are unaware of what that is, historically and traditionally, Italian families in America have always kind of done this thing on Sunday where like the whole family comes over and they like make a pot of sauce and meatballs and pasta or, you know, brujol or kind of whatever the nonna wants to make that day. And people just kind of get together and they talk and how was your week? So Frank, my partner, makes amazing eggplant. So he made like eggplant parm. I made meatballs and we invited people over. And it was on a Sunday, which I would never think about what a Sunday connotates in the United States, you know, and so, you know, it was like midday on a Sunday and these, you know, this whole group of my family showed up and they're incredible and I love them very, very much. But, you know, they walked through the door and it was like, we need to get Red Zone on football. You know, what's Red Zone? Do you have Red Zone? Why are you not a Red Zone? And oh my God, he's about, you know, Mac Jones and he's about to kick the ball. And you have, what are you doing? Like, and it was so funny to me because like, I would never go in your home and demand that you turn on the Tony Award. You know, like I would never like break down your door and be like, hey, the New York Film Festival, they're talking about, you know, Anatomy of a Fall. Why don't you have that on your screen? You know, and so it was this crazy moment where it was like, oh, and I said to our family friends who I love and adore, and I said to him, like, we have British Vogue on the coffee table. Like, read the room, dude. You know, like, I don't have Red Zone. I don't know what it is. I'm not interested in it. It sounds like additional money I have to spend every month. Like, I'm good.
It also, unsurprisingly, shows up at work.
There's been times where people are making analogies or metaphors, and they're like, oh, Nick, that's a layup. And you're like, do I still have a job? Like, is that good? I don't, you know, like, I don't know what a layup is. It'd be me being like, oh, it was a pirouette. Oil on canvas. Come on. What's wrong with you? It's a Fellini film, right? Like, it, yeah, those moments like definitely arise.
Through it all, quiet but meaningful moments happen, sometimes from strangers, at exactly the right time.
I remember talking to somebody, guy when I was living in Chicago. I said, I don't know what to do. Like, everyone at work golfs and I don't want to golf. And I remember him just being like, then don't go to the opera and don't golf. It's that simple. It's unrealistic for me to think that the world is going to change on a dime. But I think the switch eventually flips where you're like, oh, that's a them thing. That's not a me.
Right.
Like, I don't need to change to do, you know, to like, I have intrinsic value and my interests are not that avant-garde, you know, like wanting to watch independent film isn't crazy.
In addition to his love of film and art, Nick is an avid reader, often finding and sharing books that validate his lived experiences.
I read The Secret City, which everybody should read. And basically the premise of The Secret City is how queer people have been kind of backstage in Washington, D.C. I think it tracks it from either Eisenhower or FDR all the way till Bill Clinton. And it kind of breaks down each administration and talks about the queer people who were helping get these things across the finish line, or they were working with JFK on his image, or, you know, they were pushing for AIDS research, and how queer people often are placated to these roles where they're not seen. They're doing clothing for the Oscars. They're not hosting the Oscars. They're doing hair and makeup. They're creating the production design of something. They're doing costume design. If you were to look at like old Hollywood, there's so many queer people. Very few of them are household names, but I can tell you that you've seen their work, and some of their work is some of the most indelible work in kind of American culture. And so I think that's really what Secret City dives into, is like the queer influence. And I always used to joke that I was a best supporting actor, never best actor. You know, you're kind of always in the wings, you know, you're doing work behind the scenes. Adrian designs the costumes for The Wizard of Oz, which, you know, it was one of the most celebrated movies of all time, and was a gay man. And you know, designed these incredible clothes that people can look at, and in 2 seconds they can tell you who, what that costume was from and what those shoes represent. And I would say most of the American public has no clue who Adrian is.
This hidden side that the Secret City highlights is ever present. True to life representation in TV also has a long way to go.
There is great television, but it usually is about like AIDS or, you know, it's queer people do show up in television and film and theater, but it's usually not about like the accomplishments of gay people. It's rarely about like, oh, wow, this queer person went and did this amazing thing that's, you know.
That a straight person or a hetero person could. We'll just tell that story. Let's not tell the queer person's story.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You know, this world that we both coexist in, but one that is very clearly not made for you, which is the whole point of this episode, right? Do you think that that is changing?
I think the fact that I'm having this conversation, there was an amazing moment watching Fellow Travelers where my partner and I, we realized like we would probably not be allowed to own this home together 30 or 40 years ago.
But there is still trepidation about acceptance.
We were nervous about like how will neighbors react to having two gay men living next to them? Will they think we're roommates? Is this like Bert and Ernie style? Like, you know, can we put up a pride flag in June? Will it get torn down? Will people deface our home? Will they treat us differently if they see a pride flag?
True to form, Nick is hopeful. There's progress to be accounted for.
I think we're making progress. Show Pose is a favorite of mine, which is a Ryan Murphy show about the like 90s, 80s ballroom scene in New York and has a large trans cast of color. And I think the fact that that show is produced and was on mainstream television and talking about Will and Grace, like that show was on mainstream television. And I think there's more stories to be told. I think there's more stories with less tragedy to be told. But yeah, we definitely live in a different world than my parents lived in, never mind the life that my grandparents had.
Today, Nick's planning his wedding. The process is mostly full of joy, excitement, and love. But there are also little reminders of the differences he and his fiancée embody. The things non-queer people would never think of. Very real and everyday.
I remember we were booking our honeymoon and we mentioned sandals and they were like, oh, you sandals is bad and they're homophobic and they don't celebrate. And then it's like, oh my God, we can't go to any, I mean, they reversed their policy in quotes, but like they, you know, like we can't go to any sandals resort, you know, like why, you know, they're so nice. And, you know, and so there's those things that you have to think about, you know, like I had friends recently who went to Morocco and they're a lesbian couple. And one of them, you know, they kept asking where their husbands were. You know, she was like, it definitely was uncomfortable being in Morocco. And so that's just not something that I think heteronormative couples think about on a daily basis. It is funny when people kind of ask you questions about a wedding and they tend to ask you questions about your wedding from the viewpoint of like a traditional kind of Christian heteronormative wedding, which in some ways we're having, but it's just like being aware of that. Your experience is not everyone's experience. My aunt lives in the Midwest now, and there are lovely people in all parts of the country, but there's definitely times where you are, you know, like, well, how will that be accepted if I'm in this kind of small rural town? Well, there's moments where you show up and people are staring, and you know why they're staring.
Nick finds that in those moments, grace can still be given, if the intent is good.
Underrepresented groups know when something is malicious, and they know when something someone's asking out of curiosity and they want to understand better. We are able to know the difference. And so people have well-meaning and questions and they, you know, my partner and I might want to have kids and people are often unaware of what that process is like for gay men and how complicated it is. And so if people have questions about that, I'm more than happy to answer those questions and enlighten them on what that looks like. I know when someone's asking a question that is not well-intentioned. And so, yeah,
and that's an important call out too, because grace is not just doled out to everybody. You know, you have this beautiful ability to think about that other person's existence, but also you're not going to put up with shit. Both of those things can be true. And that's so important to have both of those abilities so that you're not
yeah.
a doormat and you're also not overcorrecting on aggressive or,
yeah.
you know, yeah, whatever. You know, I think that's huge. Yeah.
I'll never forget. I was at a party in college and I was sitting in this living room or whatever. And there were two girls sitting on the couch and I was, you know, probably wearing Abercrombie and Fitch and living my best life. And these girls kept gawking. They kept looking and then whispering and then looking and then whispering. And it was very evident they were gawking at me and talking about me in some capacity. So I let it happen for a bit. I just kind of sat in a chair. And okay, they're still staring. Okay, interesting, you know. And I walked over to them probably like 10 minutes, 15 minutes in. And I was like, what are you over here whispering about? And it completely caught them off guard. And they were like, oh, we were trying to figure out. And I was like, yes, I am. I'm gay. Do you want to know if I'm gay? Like, I'm gay. Yes, I am. I would rather have you come ask me that.
Unfortunately, the experiences are frequent, but he sees them as a learning opportunity for those willing to hear them.
I called somebody for a wedding shower gift, and they said, just automatically, what is the name of the bride? Just without even a hesitation, right? And I said, oh, two grooms, Ryan, Scott, you know. And she was so apologetic and she was so embarrassed. And I said, you know, it was like some woman on a customer service line. I was like, Susan, listen, don't worry about it. I didn't think that you meant it in a derogative way. Most of the people you're talking to on the phone are heterosexual couples, right? I'm not offended. And I said, what I do hope is that this is a moment of, oh, should we be changing that? Is that an opportunity to look at the policy of how we greet customers? How do we ask for the name of one of the people who's getting married? Like, what's the best way to do that?
Later this year, Nick will be marrying his wonderful partner in a small ceremony with close family. Most details are set at this point, but he felt a little lost at the beginning of the planning process. There were a lot of questions.
I think there is no representation. I wanted this photographer to have some queer couples on their website, and I, you know, wanted to find a justice of the peace or a person who's married other queer couples. And do I walk down an aisle? Do we both walk down the aisle? Does my dad walk you down the aisle? Does my mom walk you down the aisle? It is so ambiguous. It makes it really, really hard because there's really not a ton of precedent out there. I really can't think of a television show that has artfully shown a gay wedding or a movie or something like that, you know?
Right.
It's always like, oh, they're getting married in the hospital room because he's dying of AIDS, you know? Like, it's never like, you know? Like,
going back to the necessary yeah. tragedy in any queer movie yes. or a movie about queer yes. people.
Jokes aside, it's hard to navigate a path that has yet to be created. But they've landed on a place they love and a wedding ceremony with some traditional elements. Just like anyone else, they have the same midnight stresses, last-minute decisions to be made, or tailors to find.
We woke up in the middle of the night kind of in a panic. But, you know, you go to weddings, so often the food is like tepid. Like, oh, thank you for this lukewarm chicken that, you know, 70 other people got. It's been almost impossible to find. The Knot app is downloaded on my phone and it's bright pink. And not saying that guys can't be into pink, but it's just clearly so not targeted at men. I remember saying I need to get a tux and someone was like, oh, I think like, you know, this bridal shop, I'm not going to go to a bridal shop. Like, I'm a man, you know, like we're dudes.
With so little guidance, they've leaned into what made sense for them.
You know, we really wanted it to be about our love and us and bringing our families together and kind of what that looks like for the two of us.
When you think about just being married, this wedding process, the whole thing, what are you just most looking forward to?
I'm excited about just being together. I think that we have like, that sounds corny. Marriage does mean something to me, so I'm excited to be married. But I'm excited for the two of us to continue our lives together. We have a great life. We love to travel and, you know, we go to the theater and we see our families and our nieces and our nephews. And we just really have a great life. I feel extremely grateful. Life was hard. I've been through a lot, but it's, you know, I feel very grateful and I'm excited for what is possible. I'm definitely the one in the relationship whose head is a little bit in the clouds and thinks the world is filled with infinite possibility. And I'm in my mid-30s, so I might be too old for those mindsets. But I just think anything is possible. It all can come true. And Frank's great. He like grounds me and reminds me that, you know, the gas bill is due. And I'm definitely the one in the relationship who's like, we can accomplish anything together. And I'm so excited to think about what our life looks like together.
Nick is full of gratitude and optimism. He knows just what it took to get him here.
I have come to a happier place. You know, I'm truly happy in my life, and I feel very lucky. And there's a lot of people who don't make it through. And I acknowledge that I went to therapy as a child, and I had a mother who believed in that. And I had the parents that I did, and we had the circumstances that we had, and all of those things, right? And so I can't not acknowledge that, but I do feel like I've made it through to the other side. I'm lucky to be here. I'm lucky that I found love. I just feel a lot of gratitude because I know how hard it is, and I know that a lot of people don't.
With that in mind, and I'm very glad that you're here so that we got to meet at this happy point in your life. Take a moment and, as I ask everybody, pick an age or a stage in your life. What gift would you give yourself?
I'm excited to be older because I think with age, like I've never cared about getting older. I mean, it is shocking, quite shocking sometimes when you have to write down your age, but I see age as this like amazing thing. I do believe that things shake out the way that they're supposed to shake out. And, you know, if you have humility and you work hard and you give people that grace and you walk through life curious, I don't have it all figured out. I am constantly amazed and asking questions about how the world works and how it all comes together and why and who and what. And I am so grateful for that curiosity. So I hope that that continues. I hope that that curiosity sticks around. And so I'm excited to get older, which is probably a weird answer for you. People say like, oh, no. I wish I could tell my 12-year-old, you know, but I'm excited to get older and kind of see how
I look back. And, I think that that excitement about aging and looking back on your life is such a good reminder. And I find myself hearing you say that going, oh, I need to maybe reframe how I think about getting older, because that is such a good piece. And it sounds like the gift you would give is kind of more to your age right now, just a reminder to stay curious and to stay full of wonder.
I remember when I lived in Chicago, there's this moment where the train is an elevated train in Chicago, and it kind of wraps around the city, and you really get this beautiful vista, and it's absolutely stunning. And I every time I saw it, I just couldn't get over it, how beautiful it was. And I remember saying that to someone that was in like a friend of a friend who she was like, I hope you never lose that. And I'm like, I don't think I will. The world is a beautiful place. You just kind of need to take a moment to soak it all in.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, of course.
I am going to demand that you continue to put an R on the end of words that don't have R's, because that came out a little bit today and it doesn't always come out when I talk to you, and I loved it. So that is my one request as I leave you with that. As I end our episode.
When I was in first grade, I went in and I was writing our family.
Yeah.
But we would say that family.
Yeah.
So it sounds A-R-E, right? And so I think I was writing something for Mother's Day, and I was like, the way you help a family. And I wrote A-R-E, and I remember someone being like, that's because you are from Boston.
Yeah, just leave it. It's fine. Thank you, my friend. This was wonderful. I really, really appreciate it. Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Story Goes. the podcast dedicated to highlighting the everyday and celebrating the moments that shape us. The music was composed by Daniel G. Harmon, who also edits and produces this thing. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on my show, reach out to me directly at sophia@gifted.work. Thanks for listening.